From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Comedian Jeff Foxworthy sold out clubs with jokes like this.
All right, here we go. Redneck fashion tip number one. Certain things should not be sold in certain sizes. If your rear end looks like two full-grown raccoons wrestling in a 50-pound bag of feed corn, say no to spandex.
But so-called redneck culture is not a joke to at least one Southern cook. We'll meet her today, and we'll dive into a very divisive issue, it turns out, whether cornbread should be sweet or savory. You can cast your vote on our Twitter poll right now. We've already heard from a lot of you in the cornbread war, so here are your first thoughts. Victoria Stans Abernathy reached out on Facebook. She writes, "My black longtime supervisor preferred cornbread with a little bit of sugar. I outgrew that in my late 20s. I preferred a pinch of sugar to smooth out the taste of the greens, while using a bit of onion that cooked has a sweetness and mellows out the flavor of peas and greens or beans. My cornbread slathered with melted real butter and no sugar is just perfect. Add some sweet chow chow in any flavor and heaven descends. Cornbread doesn't need sugar." But our own Adam Ragusea countered with this. "Cornbread without sugar," he says, "is like pretzels without salt, not so much a food as it is a sadistic practical joke played on the eater." So we have been getting a lot of your responses here, and it seems to be neck and neck, almost tied between a sweet or savory cornbread. So call us at 404-500-9457. You can reach us on Twitter or post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. Rapper Killer Mike started out as Michael Render from Southwest Atlanta's Adamsville neighborhood. Even as a hip-hop artist, his lyrics often talk about social injustice.
"I guess that's the privilege of policing for some profit. But thanks to Reaganomics, prison turned to profit. Cause free labor's the cornerstone of U.S. economics. Cause slavery was abolished unless you are in prison. You think I am Bush and then read the 13th Amendment. Involuntary servitude and slavery it prohibits. That's why they give in trouble."
Lately, Killer Mike has become a familiar face on the campaign trail in support of Senator Bernie Sanders for president.
"When it comes to your children dying in the streets, I know that the only person that I have the conscience to vote for is Bernard Sanders. I know that the only person that my logical, beautiful black mind will allow me to vote for is Senator Bernie Sanders."
And Killer Mike joins me this morning. It's so great to have you on the show.
Good morning. I thought I was here for the cornbread debate.
Well, do you want to settle it for us?
Well, I have the answer.
What is it?
The answer is Georgia prefers sugar in their cornbread. If you get Georgia and go toward even some parts of the Carolinas, but Alabama, parts of Tennessee prefer it starchy. My grandmother's from Alabama, my grandfather's from Georgia.
So you had both.
Yeah, so his family would put, like my grandmas that are from Georgia, and my great-grandmas and aunts would sprinkle a little sugar in their cornbread, and the ones from Alabama didn't, so it's a bitter taste. It tastes like corn. It's a bitter, well, it's not sweet corn, it's like a starchier taste. I prefer the starchier one, which is why I don't eat
Jif. You prefer the not sweet.
Yeah, I prefer the Alabama version, and grits too. Grits are the same way. I prefer my grits Alabama style, like without sugar, starchy, very hearty, and my cousins in Georgia put sugar in everything, which is why.
Do you melt cheese on your grits?
Yeah, I do, but I put cheddar. I only put, none of that processed stuff, just real cheddar cheese.
Okay, well, at least we've got that settled.
So you could eat it both ways. Just feeling which side of the family you haven't dinner.
Or which side of the border, it sounds
yeah.
like. I wanted to get some other sort of business out of the way because I feel like the first question people have at this point is, keeping in mind what you've said, that Bernie Sanders is the only person you feel a conscience to vote for.
For me, yeah.
What if he doesn't get the nomination?
Well, that's something, I got asked that on another station. I said, well, the first thing I'll do is call the senator and say, what are we doing now? You know, it's the very truth of it.
So you're going to stay working in some capacity with him?
Yeah, if I can. I mean, I've become friends with him, so I don't intend to unknow him after this. I guess some entertainers that Hillary had ties to, they got paid for concerts or whatever else. Like, the only thing I've ever been paid for is a hotel room, because I'm not going to fly to talk good about you and pay for my own hotel. So I didn't do any of this for money or more fame or anything. I did it because my conscience said this is the right thing to do on the behalf of working class people in this country. So afterwards, I definitely intend to still know Senator Sanders and take some trips up to Washington or Vermont, wherever he lands. And, I want to land in the White House, but if that shouldn't happen, then I'll faithfully follow him into whatever wherever the revolution takes him, because I really believe in the things he's talking about.
And I wonder if you think it's going to change things, even if he doesn't. I want to play this clip after the grand jury decided not to indict the Missouri police officer who killed 18-year-old Michael Brown. You were in St. Louis at that time, you were about to perform, and you said this.
I have a 20-year-old son, and I have a 12-year-old son, and I'm so afraid for them. When I stood in front of my wife, and I hugged her, and I cried like a baby, I said, these motherfuckers got me today. But with that said, you motherfuckers will not own tomorrow. We will not live in your fear. We will not accept your pages. Because we know you don't value my skin.
So, I mean, it seems incongruous to some people that somebody that passionate about racial issues and so personally connected is allied with a 74-year-old white Jewish independent.
From Vermont.
Yeah.
It only feels like that because the narrative we've been told always separates us. The narrative we've been told separates men from women, separates black from white, separates Latino from American, and it separates. I have to speak in terms of race because I belong to a group of people that are critically in danger in the immediate. I'm an African-American man. I'm African-American father. I'm African-American husband. So it is easier for police encounters to go bad. It is easier for places like the Atlanta Public School System to fall into just a hole of drudgery. It is easier for these things to happen. I don't know why they're easier. I don't know why these things have been allowed, but I have to approach things from that perspective that way. But I am first and foremost always thinking about the worker class. And that's globally. It's not only race. Race is a system of class in this country. But when I go to other countries, there's still a class system, even if there isn't a difference in skin color. And ultimately, that's what I'm fighting. It just happens in this country, our class system, to some degree, is based on race. But I want to see this 74-year-old Jewish white guy in office because his policy affects my class, worker class, and black people in a positive way. And I think for all Americans, basic health care, maternity leave, the ability to matriculate your education past 12th grade and contribute to society is more than just a day laborer or someone looking for a job. You know, the poor kids get an opportunity to get specialized trades or skills like coding. Makes sense to me, no matter what color you, no matter what class you are. So that's why I support them. And I belong to the group of regular people, not corporations, where my taxes might go up a little. But if it means that we have healthier children that are smarter, that are competing on a global scale to keep this country ahead, then it's worth it.
Well, let me play a little clip from the song, because many of these things are already reflected in your music as well. This is a little bit of the song Don't Die.
We now the dirty cops looking at me, talking about he killed if I try to flee. And I'm about to lose it, so he gonna have to prove it. All because the government hate rap music. I've been labeled outlaw, renegade villain. So was Martin King, so the system had to kill him. A nigga with an attitude, the world gotta feel him. Educated villain, intent on living. If I gotta kill him.
I wonder if you think your political activism is a sort of one side of your life, and then there's the hip-hop side, or if the activism is an extension of the music.
First, you got great rhythm. I thought you bopping.
I'm bopping along, yeah.
I told my mom I was going to be a rapper when I was 9 years old, and I have been organizing actively in Atlanta since I was 15 years old. I learned how to organize from Alice Johnson, Mr. Edward Johnson, no relation, and Mr. James Orange, who was a lieutenant with Dr. King, organized with the Teamsters and other labor unions here. So I was taught by actual organizers that marched with King. I was taught by actual organizers that hit the ground running. First thing we organized, 1991, 92, was a group of kids, a group of kids who were at that time gang members, vice lords, gangster disciples, Crips, to meet with martyr policemen and basically just get martyr police to stop beating kids. Because it got to the point where kids and martyr cops were going to be shooting it out in stations. You know, it had gotten that bad in the early 90s. So what you see in an Oscar Grant happen 20 years later, it had pretty much gotten that bad even in Atlanta that time, even though it wasn't being it wasn't being televised. So that was one of the first things. Next thing was Fulton County Commission partnered with my group, Kids for a Change. It was under the leadership of Lucy Vance and the late Jean Childs Young, who was the first wife of Andrew Young. They thought that if kids are going to be organized for, they should be organized with. We as a group of kids came in, organized, and allowed forums to happen where kids from Atlanta could tell what they thought in terms of improving the city were. So all I have been for over half my life is an organizer and a rapper. So I can't unlink them. My day job is rapping. I get to yell and scream and curse, and people pay me pretty good for that. But that allows me to, on the organizational side, to maintain my integrity and to simply stand behind the truth where I see it. You know, as long as I can keep jumping around and selling T-shirts, you know, for saying dirty words, then I'll be able to be a part of the political process in a fair and unbiased way because I have a decent day job.
Although you haven't entirely, perhaps, gone the way of making the most money. I want to read this quote that you said in an interview. You said, "My name is Killer Mike, which makes it hard for me to get certain backing and endorsements from certain companies."
Yeah.
"A band like the Killers, they get great press, they get great reviews. For some reason, a 6'3" black man being Killer Mike is a little more threatening than a bunch of 5'8" white guys known as the Killers."
Who I like. I actually happen to like that band. Yeah, I mean, that's the truth on some point. I'm now in a group called Run the Jewels, me and a guy named LP from Company Flow, and we just played Coachella 2 weeks back to back. You know, thousands and thousands of kids came out and raved to us. And if you hang in the race long enough, people will progress or they'll just get old and die off. So a lot of the older people that had opinions on me that were in the industry 10, you know, 12 years ago, thankfully their career, they have just died off. And these young kids that have grew up kind of with my music and seeing my struggle, they don't care that my name is Killer Mike. They know Michael Render. So and I respect those kids for that because they ride really hard. And, you know, because of them now, you see, we have sponsorship, we have partnerships, and, you know, we're doing pretty good. You know, I'm not a rich man by any means, but I'm able to take good care of my wife and kids ultimately, and that's all any working class guy wants to do.
There has been some disagreements on social issues among the hip-hop community.
Absolutely.
I know
Absolutely.
There was a lot of pushback on Jay-Z during the Occupy Wall Street. He started selling T-shirts that said Occupy All Streets.
Yeah.
There's been pushback on other...
I think if he would have did those T-shirts for free, he wouldn't have gotten pushback.
Yeah.
You know, if he would have just dropped off.
Because he was trying to make a profit?
Well, I don't think it's the fact that he was trying to make a profit. I think that when you grow up poor and when you have to grow up using your resources, you grow up doing that. You know, it's just like the lady who technically gets food stamps, but she buys a couple of extra packs of penny candy just so when the food stamps run out, she has a way of generating some income. So I think that the hip-hop spirit, from a Jay-Z standpoint, and even mine, you think from an entrepreneurial standpoint because you've actually been poor. So I don't think that it was the wrong. I think it was a misinformed decision. I think he didn't have anyone around to say, Jay, you know, that selling it won't be the move, but if we give it away for kids to push their message, it might work. So I just think that was a slip up more than just a ignoring of the greater cause. You know, I think rappers want to get it, but I think that rappers don't have the responsibility of putting boots on the ground because I think that they have the responsibility of helping create a merchant class and they have the responsibility of helping kids financially. And what I mean by that is, when LP and I did Meow the Jewels, essentially, it's the stupidest record you've ever heard. It's all of our original lyrics with cat sounds as the beats.
Right, meow,
and,
meow, yeah.
Meow, and we have some of the best producers in the world. Instead of doing our own album, we did a dumb cat album, right? So people are like, oh, man, you guys are going to get paid. Absolutely not. All the money that comes from the proceeds of Meow the Jewels goes directly to a charity that pays for lawyers to get protesters out of jail. So I can't come down out the clouds and be at every march, but what I can do is use my music to help influence the struggle in a greater way. So when Jay-Z and Beyonce gave money to Black Lives Matter, or when they do things like that, that's what rich people are supposed to do. That's what rich blacks did during the Civil Rights Movement.
I guess this hour is Killer Mike. The hip-hop artist and activist is also an entrepreneur. His Graffiti Swag Barbershop on Atlanta's South Side is one of the more popular places to get your haircut in the city. And Mike has been in the studio lately. It was a late night for you?
Yeah.
Which I appreciate getting up. This is early for a hip-hop.
I didn't want to go to sleep. I just had to go home first.
To sleep at all?
Well, I slept for a couple. I didn't want to. I wanted to just stay in the studio and just come straight here, but my wife didn't come to the studio with me. So you as a married man, you ain't going to hang out a couple extra hours here and say, I just went to radio. You're going to get your butt home report to the probation office.
Fair enough.
The boss, as my friends call her.
So you almost ran for office.
Yeah.
Kind of started to run for office.
Yeah. I just really wanted to make people aware that there was a race going on. You know, I'm going to tell people, you politicians, you have nothing to worry about right now. Regular
You're not
going to
run for office eventually?
Eventually, but eventually it's not going to happen in the next 2 years. You know, I'm having a successful rap career. Like, you get to, I got four children. Now, these people need private school and college tuition, so I got to kind of keep rapping, but I'm definitely going
to... You got to make the Tubmans.
Exactly. Got to make... Oh, man, I'm so proud of that, too, and we'll talk about that. But, thank you, Harriet. Do you ever realize this country is often called an empire, an imperialistic colonizer. This country just put a black woman guerrilla warrior on a $20 bill for a man who was a slave owner and just a genocidal maniac to Native Americans. I think that is the most progressive thing to happen in the last 3 months, at least.
Do you talk about this stuff with your kids?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. You never know how much they're taking in until they argue back with you. I remember when my daughter, who's now 18, was 13, and I was chastising her about dressing like Marilyn Monroe for because that woman was cheap, and you know how you go into self-righteous debt. She was cheap when she slept with brothers, and you know all that typical bigotry that men have. And she looked me squarely in the eyes and said, "Oh, I should be Harriet Tubman or Shirley Chisholm." Oh, okay. Well, Pony is Jason. He's Jason, Dad. He's Jason. Pony Boy is Jason. You didn't look for black serial killers for him to be. I just looked down and told her, the dress is nice. And
for those who don't know that, that's the nickname of your son.
Yeah, Pony. I named Pony Boy after my favorite character in The Outsiders. As a kid, I loved that book. We're going to read it together this summer, too, me and him. I want to say, too, I asked my daughter, I said, why did you pick Marilyn Monroe? And she enlightened me. She said, Dad, did you know she was the first, quote unquote, full figured woman to be essentially celebrated? And I hadn't thought, you know, in terms of a boy, if you're chubby, skinny, whatever, you're a boy, you can play a sport, people will like you. But I'd never thought about the body, in terms of a little girl, you're trying to understand this body you're in. You're trying to find examples of that you like so you'll like yourself. You know what I mean?
I
didn't accredit her for being as brilliant as she is per our conversations over, you know, the years. And I lost that one. I took that L gladly. Like, my daughter's smart. She also showing cleavage. I don't know how to feel about that, but, you know, she's a bright girl.
You know, Chuck D once described hip hop as the CNN of the ghetto, I think is what he called it. Do you think that's still true? Because a lot of some of the top selling albums are...
If that means has lost some of its grit, maybe. You know, I think that CNN was, you know, just a good word for just saying rap is the news of what's going on. You know, I'm doing a podcast that's going to be coming out on Huffington Post, and the podcast talks about Reconstruction right before Civil War. I mean, it talks about slavery right before Civil War and Reconstruction. And you often think, you know, that somehow things are in our community or just here, or they just happened, but it's kind of been this way. So, you know, I think that there isn't one narrative. You know, there are many narratives. I've learned a lot, you know, just kind of bouncing around. But you know, I don't know. I'm just kind of living through it.
But some of the people in your business have said they've been swayed by your passion for Bernie Sanders. And I want to read another thing that you said not long after Michael Brown's death, which seems to have hit you really hard.
It did.
You said, I'm appalled that regular Americans are apathetic. I'm appalled at everyday citizens. When will we, as an American constituency, tell our politicians enough is enough?
Yeah.
I'm sure you don't mean all Americans are apathetic, but do you see yourself as sort of an evangelist in terms of trying to get people into politics?
I don't. My wife does. You know, she says it. I don't. I just, man, I'm very frank in that. Luther Campbell, Uncle Luke, and Larry Flint have been as influential to me, you know, in my political shaping as Martin and Malcolm or any other body I've looked up to. You know, I am about freedom, so we're only going to be here a few short years. You know, and I think that it is absolutely deplorable that in the few years we're here, 70, 80, 90, 100, if we're lucky, that we have to accept poverty, that we have to accept homelessness, that we have to accept mental illness, that we have to accept subpar education. We shouldn't accept these things. We shouldn't accept them for ourselves. And if we don't accept them for ourselves, we should feel that they're not worthy of other human beings. Every human being deserves to go through this magical existence called life in a way that's unbothered. in a way that they're unchained to debt and hurt and harm. So, you know, I've just decided that in my life, whatever I can do to progress into a more humane place is what I want to do. Am I evangelist in some way, I guess I am, because I know that you being active in local politics changes things. I know that. I don't believe that. It's not something I heard in theory. It's not, you know, I'm not a celebrity that woke up to this epiphany 2 days ago. No, I've seen it in Atlanta. I've seen in my lifetime what an active political constituency can do to shape and move government. You know, and I think that as Americans, if we paid more attention, not to ourselves and our needs based on ego, but to ourselves and our needs based on our community and what will make our community better, I think we'd get more active locally. And if you get more active locally, you're going to be more active statewide. And if you're more active statewide, it's going to take your thinking up to nationally, you know? So I would like to see all of us be more active on a local level. And the real truth of it is, after this presidential election, I got a mayor's election coming up in Atlanta. We got state reps coming up a couple years after that. So my thing is, I'm going to be active for the next few years in terms of I want to see my community shaped in a way that I think Maynard Jackson would have liked. I want to see my community shaped in a way that I think working class people of Atlanta have a shot. We have one of the largest wealth disparities in the country in this city.
I think number one.
Yeah, I've heard number one. I didn't want to throw us on the track. But yeah, we're number one. We're number one. Like, think about that. Atlanta's one of the best, safest, easiest places for black people to even progress. When you start looking at Detroit's and Compton's and even Harlem now, it's one of the best places. And with that, the income disparity is still number one in the nation. We got a lot of waking up to do. We got a lot of, you know, we got a lot of moving to do here.
But it's, you know, they always say that the more money you get, the more conservative you become.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Yes.
That hasn't been true for me.
But it is true for other entertainers, certainly.
Yeah, absolutely.
Who go from rags to riches and then want to keep those riches.
Yeah. I mean, you can keep your riches. You know, you can keep your riches. I mean, there's ways to be rich. I mean, I have friends that are Canadian that are millionaires. I have friends that are citizens of the UK that are millionaires before me. So I'm just like, it's possible, but it isn't. You know, I watched the TED Talks. I forgot who it was, but this young man speaking, he's a 100 millionaire or billionaire. He said, you know, that our idol worship of the rich has put us in a place where we're defending people who don't have a concern for us. If you make sure a 100 millionaire can keep his $100 million, he's going to buy one house. He's going to have a couple cars. His kids are going to go to a better school. If you take that 100 millionaire, if he is taxed, say 25%, 25 of those $1 million are now back in the circulation of this country, back in the jobs creation, back into some type of workforce. That $25 million becomes salary for more than 25 million people. That salary has those people who are now working in middle class buying things. The things they buy come from stores. Those stores have to hire people. The people who work in those stores take their money, they buy things. So you only grow an economy when you're paying the people that are quote unquote on the bottom. You're not growing an economy by paying or letting people on the top keep everything. And I'm not saying take from people. I'm simply saying that if we keep ignoring that there is a growing underclass in this country, eventually something's going to happen and not good.
But you know, people are expecting the African-American turnout, which was at a record high because during Obama's runs for office, to drop significantly.
Yeah.
And part of that is because it's African Americans often report they feel the political system is rigged and that their vote doesn't really count. Yeah. How do you answer that? Because what you're talking about, that apathy, seems to be on both sides of the aisle. It's either angry or apathetic.
Yeah, I remember when the Republicans were putting $2 million out to investigating the African American vote. And I remember reaching out to Rafi Williams and just saying, Rafi, his Juan Williams' son, just saying, if you want that African American vote, you should take that $2 million, you should put together a barbershop campaign. And you should go to barbershops and you should target African American men. I was like, you're not going to get African American women. I'm going to be very frank with you. I'm not saying you're not going to get any of them, but 40 to 60 year old, you're probably not going to do. And Hillary's numbers are showing you that's true. 18 to 36, you stand a chance at. So I would target people in that culture. Why? African-American men are disenfranchised, most likely to not be able to get a job. Republicans talk about entrepreneurship. They talk about limited government. African-American men are involved in government in ways they don't like to be. The libertarian stance, if it didn't hold such racism by the people who are leading it, black men would flock to the libertarian stance if they didn't have...
If it wasn't associated with...
If it wasn't associated with overt racism. They would have man, it'd be like having Puppy Chow in a room full of puppies because it makes sense. You know, hold on, free speech, yep. Own gun, yep. I could have the ability to have my own business without government, yep. But none of the people who could appeal to them are because they're propped up by racism. They're propped up by wanting to keep the order the way it is. They're propped up by weird Christian values. They're propped up by things that don't allow them to fully engage an audience that's sitting there waiting. The Democrats have not done a very good job at keeping black men involved, and I think that's purposeful, to be very honest with you. So for me, in terms of the people that are disenfranchised for apathy or anger, we need you a part of the process even more than the people who are in it, because the people who are in it is already working for it. They already got their mortgages. They already got whatever. You know, I need angry and the apathetic people to kind of rise up off the bench and say, we want to have a say, too.
Okay, so we've got about 40 seconds left, and we talked earlier about how you want to continue working with Bernie Sanders, but will you leave the president part blank on the ballot if Bernie Sanders is not the nominee?
No, I'm not saying I'm going to do that. I'm saying I'm seriously going to call him and say, what do we do now? I mean, and that's, you know, and it sounds cute and it sounds like it, but it's not a joke. Like, what are we? I have accepted your challenge to be a part of a political revolution, and that revolution will continue whether you're president or not, because what you've done is waking up Americans to a new way of thinking. The greatest part about this republic, as I learned as a kid, is that we have the ability to transform it at any time. That's what constitutional amendments have been about. So when you say, hey, we can't have one payer system, why can't we? We can do whatever we decide to. We couldn't go to the moon until we decided to. So for me, I think as a country, when we make the decision that this revolution will go on, it will go on. So I'm with Sanders all the way.
Killer Mike, hip-hop Grammy Award-winning artist, activist, as you heard. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Celeste.
The first African-American police officers were sworn in Georgia 69 years ago today. 9 black police officers joined the Savannah Police Department on May 3rd, 1947. They became known as the Original 9. John White was the first to take the oath. Producer Linda Chen spent a recent afternoon in Savannah with retired Lieutenant White as he reflected on that day.
My mother and father went down to City Hall to await the arrival of the rest of the nominee, and I was there too early. So Mayor Kennedy stated, well, while we are waiting, I'll swear you in. So he swore me in before the other 8 arrived, and then we, all 8 of us, were sworn in together as the first black police officer in the state of Georgia. When we first got on, we had a lot of hostility. We were not allowed to walk in a white neighborhood in uniform. Back then, they didn't want us to wear no guns, only carry a nightstick. We had to go over to the precinct, change clothes into uniform, and to be picked up and carried down to the barracks. And they would send the rookies to take us to court. And they would stay at the precinct. Then we'd come back and wash the car out. Now they put the junk and everything in the back seat of the car, but they never wash it out, but they wash it out whenever we got into it. Oh yeah, I've been shot at more times than I got pinned, but not hit. I got tired of being cursed, being pushed. Many days I thought of quitting. But my papa said, stick there. Don't quit. Because you are changing the course of history. We walked about 8 years before we got in a patrol car. Just from 1949 until 1958. I was the first driver of that patrol car. And it was a pleasure and honor to get in. At that time, the patrol car didn't have broken windows, not no floorboards, and we were proud. I spent 38 and a half years as a police officer. Of all the originals, all have deceased. I'm the only one living today. We caught hell, the nine of us. It's worth it. And they made it possible to have what we have today, black chief of police, assistant chief of police. The whole city changed.
That was retired Lieutenant John White. He became the first black police officer in Georgia 69 years ago. Today you can see pictures of Lieutenant White and his patrol car at gpbnews.org. This is On Second Thought. Francine Bryson is a self-proclaimed redneck. She's also a championship baker who watched her mother and grandmothers whip up Southern suppers in the kitchen every Sunday. Bryson takes those classic recipes and makes them her own in the new cookbook, Country Cooking from a Redneck Kitchen. Francine Bryson will be at Barnes & Noble in Alpharetta tonight to share some of these culinary secrets. But first, she joins me now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Can we deal with the word redneck first? Because a lot
Sure.
of people find that derogatory.
Well, yeah, I know. I get this everywhere. The cool thing about it is Jeff Foxworthy is actually the one that started calling me redneck on national TV, and it stuck. So I said, hey, if he can do it and get away with it, we're going to stick with it. But honest and truly, the word redneck comes from years and years ago when the farmers would be out working in the fields. The back of their necks get sunburnt, so they called them rednecks. And it's nothing derogatory or demeaning. It was actually hardcore people that lived off the land. And it's we still do that. I still grow my own vegetables and raise my own chickens and eat my own eggs and all that. So it's a good thing for me, to me. And, you know, I hate that people are small-minded to where they think it's a derogatory statement.
One of the things I love about this cookbook, it's just so unfamiliar to me. I mean, there's stuff in here. There's a cheeseburger pie.
Right.
There's squirrel in here,
yeah.
Which you admit is not for everybody.
Exactly.
But
they only let me put one wild game in there. I was like, oh, I want to put deer, and I want to put the squirrel, and I want to put rabbit. And they're like, no, you're not doing all that. And I said, at least let me have one. So I figured squirrel was the less evasive for everybody. But you can substitute chicken if you want to.
And you said they taste like chicken.
Well, they kind of do taste like chicken. But they, to me, and a lot of people, I don't know if people will agree or disagree, but to me, squirrel tastes like a non-greasy duck. It's real lean. It's real rich. It's not full of fat. It's not greasy. But it's just, it has a really good flavor to it. It just takes a whole bunch of them to make a meal because they're tiny. So,
you know, one of the things I looked, because we're having this debate between sweet cornbread or savory,
right.
And it looks from your cornbread salad like you fall on the savory end.
Well, I actually like both. I like, if I'm going to eat it just by itself, I want the sweet. But the savory is good for like salads or fritters, or if you're making spoon breads, the savory works good for that. And I also have a recipe where you take the savory cornbread, you put chili in it, and then put more cornbread on top and cook it together. So you've got chili stuffed cornbread. So
that sounds good.
It's so good. That's going in another book. But yeah, I like them both. But you also have the cakey cornbread against the grainy cornbread.
The Jiffy.
Right. So I like them both. And my dressing recipe actually has Jiffy and the grainy and savory. So it just depends on your taste. I mean, some days you're just a little sweet. Some days you're a little savory.
How do you go about when you're writing down these recipes? And it sounds like some of them have been passed down.
Oh, yeah.
How do you go about making sure you've written them in a way that an inexperienced cook could make them? You know what I mean? Because
right.
you're so practiced in the kitchen, there must be
right.
things that you do without even thinking.
I actually, and that's one of the hardest things is coming up with the measurements, because a lot of the recipes that are passed down, there's no measurements. It just says a dash of salt or a dash of this or a dash of that. And learning to cook with measurement spoons and measurement cups is one of the hardest things for me to adapt to. But writing the recipes, even the ones that have been passed down, I actually have to do the recipe, measure it, and write it down. I have a laptop sitting in my kitchen, and I'm typing as I'm measuring and making. So that was the best thing my husband ever did. Is he says, here's a laptop for your kitchen. And it's red,
it
just like
there.
The kitchen. It stays in there.
Do you have to put plastic over it to keep a flour from getting into the keys?
I have it on the island, and I work on my counter. So I have it. I'll turn around and type and everything, but I keep a can of that spray stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Because air, I spray it like 15 times a day.
I wanted to ask a little bit about Southern cooking in general, because
right.
we've seen some real changes in
yes.
in how would you describe our evolution on the views of Southern cooking?
Well, one of the things, what I actually like, and a lot of people, they read this book and they go, oh, look at the food she's eating. We don't eat this every day. We don't
it's
eat
very
heavy, rich.
Rich
foods every day. We eat a lot of salads, and especially in the summertime in the South. It's hot down here. We're not, you know, cranking the stove and oven. I mean, it's Sunday. It's when you're eating your heavy foods and things like that, or making something for family gatherings or casseroles for there's a funeral or, you know, somebody's having a party or something like that. But I think Southern food is now trendy. You can get it everywhere. I'm proud of that. I'm proud that the rest of the country is seeing what we've always known. And I think it's really great that people have adapted to Southern food. I like it lightened up. I like grilled a lot. We do a lot of grilling in the summertime because I'm baking. I'm already heating my house up. I'm not putting a cast iron pan on top of the stove and heating it up even worse. But I think it's in the evolution of Southern food. And the lighting of Southern food, I think it's awesome. I mean,
lightening, you mean taking out some of the fat and
up,
calories.
Right, taking out the fat. In fact, my next book is, I'm doing gluten-free, I'm doing sugar-free, I'm doing lightened up recipes. I've got a whole chapter. I'm working on a whole chapter. It's got like 40 salad recipes. So, I mean, I don't eat like that all the time. I mean, but I love my pork chops. I love my cube steak. I love my gravy. I like it on my fries. But, I mean, we don't, it's not an everyday thing. But the recipes are so adaptable in this book, and I've simplified them so much to where if there's something in there you don't like, take it out. The pork chops will work without gravy. The casserole will work without gravy. You can change it up to be whatever you want it to be.
So, if I could have you explain, there's a lot of the tone, your voice comes through so clearly in this book, which is not true of every cookbook, so that's a lovely thing. But help me understand what dinner on the ground is.
Dinner?
Because as soon as I heard that, I thought it meant a picnic, like on a...
It kind of does. It kind of does. But us being raised, I was raised half Baptist, half Church of God. So dinner on the ground for us is that one Sunday in the month where... The preacher says, okay, next Sunday we're having dinner on the ground. Everybody brings their potluck favorite and there's like 30 different fried chickens and 20 green beans. And, you know, everybody loves grandma's macaroni and cheese. So everybody brings their potluck meal. You get your food and you sit at picnic tables or on blankets or on, you know, tablecloths you set. And you literally would sit on the ground and have dinner on the ground. And that's where it come from. But it also means picnic. It also means, you know, throw a sandwich in a basket and go off and spend the afternoon out in a park somewhere. And it's just let life happen around you. Just calm down, take a few minutes, and take it all in.
But it sounds like it's also associating food with family and joy.
Well, everything in my book, and that's one of the things that I guess I'm preaching, but... Food is family, and food should bring your family together. And it's like I said, I was interviewed, and a lady says, I love the statement where you say, leave your screen at the screen door. And it's true. We have a rule in our house. When it's dinner time or lunchtime or we're together, you turn your cell phone off. You leave it alone. There's no iPads, no laptops, no nothing going. We're together. We're catching up with the kids. We're finding out what's going on because everybody's so busy. Our lives are chaotic. So that's our chance to keep up. Even if we're at a restaurant, there's no cell phones, there's no iPads, no nothing. It's family time, and that's what food should do. You're communicating with each other face-to-face, and you're enjoying a great meal.
My guest is National Pie Champion and competitive cook, Francine Bryson. She's author of Country Cooking from a Redneck Kitchen. She will be at Barnes & Noble in Alpharetta tonight at 7 to share more from her book. Such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
When it comes to soul food, cornbread is required on any truly Southern plate. But while cornbread unites the South, it also divides us.
You gonna eat your cornbread?
No, not at all. I want you to have it.
Hey, man, he gonna eat his cornbread, all right?
Maybe I ought to eat your cornbread.
But if you try to take my cornbread, part two of my killing spree gonna begin right now.
That's comedy, but opinions on cornbread are no joke. Kathleen Purvis writes, there is a racial divide over ingredients. Purvis is the food editor with the Charlotte Observer, and she joins me on the line from Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. I assume you grew up eating cornbread.
Yeah, I sure did. I grew up with all kinds of styles of things. My parents were very wide travelers in food culture.
And so what kind of cornbread did you grow up eating?
My parents would have made the unsweet kind. You know, cornbread was always made either in the cornstick molds or in the skillet. And, of course, the classic way of doing that was that you melted shortening in a cast iron skillet in the stove, and then you pour in the batter so it gets that good crunchy crust on the bottom. But sweet, no. My people would not have done sweet cornbread.
So when did cornbread split ways anyway?
Well, you know, in the story that I did, this actually goes back a long way. Cornbread itself, you know, cornmeal was a staple all over the South going back into the 1600s, the 1700s. And they used it in a lot of different ways. You had you had corn pones, you had hoe cakes, you had Johnny cakes, you had all these different things. And mostly people didn't put sugar in their cornbread. They didn't need to, because in those days, cornmeal came from white corn that was a little bit sweet naturally. But then in the early 20th century, when things began to get more industrialized, cornmeal started to be made from yellow corn because it was cheaper. It wasn't as sweet. It was usually used before it was fully ripe, so the sugars hadn't developed, and the bran was removed so that it kept longer, and that made it a little less sweet. And so since it was inexpensive, people started using it and trying to kind of get back to that old flavor by adding some sugar. And that's about the time when apparently the African-American culture started to move toward adding a little more sugar to it, going with something that was a little more cake-like, while the white Southerners tended to stay with the yellow corn meal that they were more familiar with that never needed sugar and usually didn't have sugar. And then it developed into two different styles.
So that sounds like you're saying at some point everybody's cornbread was sweet because they were using sweet corn.
Well, it was sweet in a very limited way. I mean, it was sweet in the way that, say, you know, corn tastes sweet, but it doesn't have sugar in it. You know, when you get that really sweet, super sweet corn in the summertime, you know, how it's got that sweetness, you know, that's the kind of sweet we're talking about. You know, it didn't have sugar added. And you remember, sugar was very expensive once upon a time. That was a luxury ingredient. So people living back in rural areas further away from cities wouldn't have had easy access to sugar, and they didn't just put it in everything.
Now, in your piece, you also talk about, and we're talking about the antebellum period, the period just after the Civil War. And in your article, you talk about recipes we have with the black cooks' names on them that were cake-like.
Mm-hmm.
But those were supposed to be special event recipes.
Right. Those would have been things that they might have been cooking for the owners in the big house, who many of them came from European backgrounds, and they had a taste for cakes, for things like scones and that kind of thing. And, you know, they're trying to adapt to the cornmeal that was available in America. And so they probably passed on a cooking style that was a little bit more leavened, a little puffier, a little fancier. But that's not what people ate on a daily basis, and particularly not people, both African-American and white subsistence farmers, would have eaten something a lot more austere.
So by 1936, it looks like there was a full half cup of sugar in the Negro Culinary Arts Club recipe.
Yeah.
Which is that's a lot of sugar.
That's Jiffy corn mix, you know? I mean, one of the other things that began to happen in the early 20th century, by the 1930s, you started having these mixes around, and people started to like that taste. And so a lot of African Americans, particularly people who had left in the Great Migration to go to other areas of the country where they could get better jobs, Oftentimes, you know, they were working and were using mixes to probably to save time, but also they were pretty inexpensive. And so that idea of a very cake-like cornbread really came out of those. And when you look at that recipe for 1936, boy, you look at it and that is Jiffy Mix. It's got flour added to it. It's got a lot of sugar. You know, it's going to be a very puffy, very cake-like version.
You know, here's the thing, though. This is not just about ingredients at this point. Culturally, people get very angry, even.
Boy, do they ever. You should have seen my email and the comments online on the story. Yeah, it really, you know, people argued about it for days. They're still putting comments on there, you know, and it's hilarious because it, and I don't mean to sound that in any way disrespectful. As a food writer, I write about culture in food a lot, and it I love hearing how passionate people get about how their family cooked, because that's your family identity. That's what says, here's who we are, here's what we eat, you know? And something like this, people get very emotional about it. They get vehement if you try and suggest anything other than what their grandmother did.
So what is Southern cornbread?
Southern cornbread is a divider and a uniter.
I mean, but is Southern can we say whether Southern cornbread is either sweet or not?
No, I don't think you can say that any more than you can say who is a Southerner, because a Southerner is a number of different people, a number of different districts. Where, you know, the South is extremely diverse and rich with that diversity. And so, you know, it's like saying what's the one true barbecue? Well, you can't. It depends on where you're from, where you're eating it, who you're from, what your folks did. You know, those are the things that shape your taste for barbecue, and it's the same way with cornbread.
Kathleen Purvis is the food editor with the Charlotte Observer. Kathleen, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for your interest.
That's our show for today, but help us settle this debate if we can settle it. There are a few hours left to take our poll. Sweet cornbread or not sweet? Here's more of what you've said about it. Javada Partridge writes, real cornbread does not have sugar in it. Savory is the key. Hashtag where all y'all from? JPB's own Tom Barclay says, the cornbread in sausage cornbread stuffing, our family's go-to at Thanksgiving, should be savory. Standalone cornbread should be sweet with plenty of butter. It sounds like he agrees with the chef, Francine Bryson. And Rustin Meyer adds, I think Chris Rock summed it up best when he said, cornbread ain't nothing wrong with that, which I interpret in the present context to mean that there's no wrong way to prepare cornbread. I might be with Rustin. You can call us at 404-500-9457. You can tweet us at OST Talk or respond on Facebook. For today, that is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.